I'm definitely alive and awake and here.
So, do you know what you have?
You're going to have to be more specific than that.
Okay. Do you know what your current time-restricted illness is?
Some form of cold, I would imagine.
So you're not one stomach flu away from your goal weight?
I am more than one stomach flu away from my goal weight, unfortunately.
Okay, well, whenever you get hungry, just eat a cube of cheese.
Yeah, to keep me from passing out.
Mm-hmm.
I could go for a cube of cheese.
Everybody can go for a cube of cheese, unless you're lactose intolerant. But cubes of cheese are good. In general, I find. Rectangles are okay, too. Rectangular prisms. You could probably do something like a diamond, like a rhombus shape. That'd be okay. Maybe little pyramids. Little pyramids of cheese.
Are you pitching me another business idea?
All my business ideas appear to be cheese-based.
Rhombus-shaped cheese.
Yeah. Like last week's spray cheese.
That was a big hit, I think, actually.
Yeah. I mean, well, who doesn't think that Spider-Man should shoot spray cheese? You know, I mean, we can't give away all of our ideas. I should probably, you know, zip my lips to prevent any corporate espionage of our completely public podcast.
Yeah, we're going to have to start charging for these ideas at some point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like, I don't know, $1? That sounds like a lot, doesn't it?
Dollar cube of cheese club?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Oh, send us $1 and every week we'll send you a cube of cheese?
Not every week, every month. It's a cheese of the month club. It's a cheese cube of the month club. But the joke will be on them because it'll always be cheddar because that's the cheapest one.
Yeah, you know what they say, ABC, always be cheddar.
Yes. Yes, they do say that. So this is going well.
Ill-advised is what this is.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Wait, people advise us?
No, not at all. It's probably why we're still doing this. How was your week?
My week was fine. I went to that Jason's coworker's wedding, and did that.
And then you wore a pink tie.
I was told I had to wear it, but it's okay. I made him wear the green one. I would have rather had the green one, to be perfectly honest. But I've been complimented on the tie that I don't own, so sorry everyone, you'll never see it again. Well, I mean, probably not never, but I don't care for weddings very much, but that one was actually okay. Sometimes you go to those weddings and nobody wants to get on the dance floor, and then sometimes you go to those weddings and everybody gets on the dance floor, and this is definitely one of the latter situations where there was dancing to be had. And quite a wide variety of music, but for some reason there was this little girl. I don't even know the name of her name. But since the start of when they first kicked it off on the dance floor, she did nothing but the Macarena to everything, literally everything. It was kind of amazing because it went with a lot more songs than you would have imagined. Something about the rhythm. I don't know.
Yeah, she's just really trying to bring it back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Did you get out there and do yourself a chicken dance?
Yeah. No, I did not. I did the white guy shuffle. You know,
got a conga line.
No conga lines. No conga lines. No hokey pokey. Nothing.
Hmm. That sounds sad.
It was a lot of fun. But then you decided to become an incubus for viral plague. So how did that go?
I went outside, which is against my normal rules. And when I returned, I felt ill.
Oh, well, that's what you get for going outside.
Yeah.
Shouldn't have done that.
Yeah, generally, I jump on the medication pretty quick to try and, you know, knock it out in the first 24 hours, but it was having none of that, so I was doped up on the NyQuil for a couple days.
Oh, did you... Well, what I always do, if I feel like I have a head cold, I immediately hop on the driver's license meth Sudafed, that one. The one that it's just like, oh, my heart's beating so fast, and it says it shouldn't do that. That's the one. That will really knock it out of you, or at least make you feel like you can do things. So that's good.
Hmm. Yeah, I go straight for the vitamin C and the zinc, and if all else fails, the NyQuil and DayQuil. But Yeah, the mix of that and the fact that I haven't had any coffee in like 3 days has just left me in this stupor.
Well, coffee's
important. No one will be able to tell the difference, to be honest, but, you know, I feel different.
I hear a difference. the listeners will be like, oh, God, what's wrong with Dan? And so, well, I just want to make sure they know that Dan only took vitamins, and so that's why he's sick.
Yeah, well, no, I took medication, too. Okay. We'll just tell them that you edited this episode, and that's why I sound different.
And then a drop of water for homeopathy reasons. But, so anything else we should catch up on before? There was some news today, which will be some future date, as yet to be determined by our audience. But there was some news on A-Day where Recode Media, re/code, .net. What a domain name. Was having their media summit in at the Ritz-Carlton down in Dana Point, which is lovely. And I highly recommend that people go there for reasons or something. But it's a good place to hold a conference, and they did with a special appearance by Warner Brothers CEO. And not just like Warner TV, not just like the Warner chief executive officer, that guy,
Mr. Warner.
In case you were wondering what CEO stood for, it's chief executive officer. Not cats eating oranges, but
how much coffee have you had today? Did you take some of that that meth medication just for funsies, just like out of?
just to make sure I didn't get sick from you by proxy.
Right, yeah.
I don't want to pick up anything over this podcast, you know.
To have a sympathy medication or whatever it's called.
Sure. So Kevin Tsuchihara, who is the head honcho, had a very candid interview, and unfortunately does not come off super great in it. Because it's kind of sad, really. Because he acknowledges that there are a lot of problems with the current system in Hollywood and how they distribute and market movies, but that they don't have any answers for that, and that they will continue to work on moving Ultraviolet forwards, which is just not a super inspiring sentiment, since I don't think it's done very well.
Have you ever watched a movie on Ultraviolet?
I have never. I know I should for research purposes or something, but I literally have no desire to go out of my way to do any of that stuff. It is pure convenience for me.
I wouldn't even know where to start with that product. I know it exists, or at least I knew that it existed at one point. I wasn't sure that it still existed, but I have never once sought out watching a movie on Ultraviolet. I don't even know if I own any that I can watch on Ultraviolet.
See, I think that is a large part of the problem, is that they were very unsuccessful at communicating what Ultraviolet was, how you would use it, and how easy it would be to use. And all of the reporting I have ever read has only left a vague impression that involves Flickster. And the idea of logging into some web app thing to load in a number thing from another thing, or to go to a Walmart and then turn over my DVDs to them so that they can be
exchanged.
Yeah, that's the thing. It just, like, the whole thing just seems so bizarre to me that I can't comprehend it. I was actually in I was in a Target when I was in Tampa, and they had a movie that, I can't even remember what it was. It was like something I had wanted to see but had not seen yet. And I picked it up, and it was like digital distribution. You can get the Blu-ray. This package has the DVD too, and you can also get a digital code. And I was like, well, okay, fine. So what's the deal? And then you turn it over on the back, and it's like Ultraviolet. And I was like, no, thank you. I don't even want to touch it. Like, you know how Steve Jobs infamously said that Blu-ray was a bag of hurt? I can't even imagine what Ultraviolet is a bag of, because I don't even want to touch it. that's how bad it is.
Let's see. It's a bag of something, and you don't want to touch it. I can think of a few things.
Yes, yes, but I will set it on a fire and put it on somebody's doorstep. But the it is so sad, and I feel kind of bad for him, for Kevin Tsuchihara, the CEO, because it's just like, well, he can't really do much in this position, because if he does something, if he risks anything, and it backfires in any small way, then everyone will pounce on him and get him to go back to the old way and get rid of him. It is not an enviable position to be in, because you have to toe the company line of, I know this doesn't work, but please use this thing. And all of your fellow CEOs at all of the other companies have to toe exactly the same line of, I know this doesn't work, please use this thing. It is so weird to me. So I highly recommend that people go read it, and it'll be in the show notes. Dan, where can people find the show notes?
While you take your pulse to see if you're actually all right, I will tell them it is at defocus.co/36, because this is our 36th episode.
Okay. Do you need to clear your throat? You need a cough button?
No, this is actually how I talk right now.
Oh, that's great. It's gravelly for...
It's gravelly. I can maybe parlay it into a career in doing voiceovers for car commercials or something. Probably trucks.
Like a rock.
That's copyrighted. Don't do that.
I know. Okay.
Strike that from the record.
I'm sorry, Chevrolet, with your beautiful, stupid cars and your manliness ads. But the... not to get sidetracked. Another very sad thing is he also mentions the Sony situation, the Sony hack, and also the interviews release a couple times, and he laments that they didn't do more for Sony, which is kind of a wishy-washy thing to say at this point, because it seemed pretty obvious that they should have had something to say about it when it had happened, and the fact that they released absolutely no statement does not inspire a lot of confidence. And again, I think this is one of those things where nobody really wanted to stick their neck out, and that it would have been a risk in exposing their company to a risk, and that it was just safe to just sit there. So
say in retrospect what he thought he might have been able to do?
No, he just laments that they should have done more. More than nothing. If there was one thing I could do, it would be one thing. But the whole situation is just ludicrous. I don't blame him specifically. I think it is a product of the corporate culture at the studios that produces this kind of sentiment where you can't really be that risky. I think that the riskiest thing he might have done might have been this interview where he is so frank about many things. And it has largely been overlooked, especially news that they have absolutely no current plans to work with Apple on any sort of entertainment streaming package at all. One of the perennial rumors is that Apple is going to release a special TV, but they're waiting until they get all the content deals in the right place. And as this comes up often, you know, they'll say like, oh, they're right on the verge of the content deals, and obviously that's not really the case. And they have not produced any major change in Apple TV in years. To say that the current system is a little long in the tooth would be polite. So if it is being held up for content stuff, it doesn't sound like any content stuff is moving forwards. So that is also something to lament, because that just means you could use Ultraviolet more. Yay!
Well, we could always assume that he's just not allowed to say anything, but at a minimum, whether or not they're going to do anything new with Apple TV or this new TV product, I sure would appreciate something iTunes Match-like for my movies, because I'm at the point with my physical media where I really just want to like take a week and just rip every Blu-ray I have to a digital file and then just throw the Blu-rays in the trash because I don't ever want to use them again. I just want to use the digital files in iTunes or my Apple TV. But if they all live on my laptop or my Drobo here, I can't really get to them from my TV very easily now, can I?
No, but if you invest in a system that can play ultraviolet content, then you can go to a Walmart and turn in all of your Blu-rays.
And what exactly would that system be? Does there any hardware that has ultraviolet built into it, or is it all sort of laptop-based web browser stuff?
I couldn't even tell you. I know that Amazon's Fire TV does not have an app or service that complies with their system. And I know that Apple's, of course, does not comply with their system. So I am at a loss for what you would have that would work for this. I can't even tell you if you can stream from any sort of app that they have via AirPlay. They've just done a tremendously bad job at communicating how people should consume media this way. You know, part of that is because they acknowledge that that people aren't watching things via legal means, and that there's a lot of piracy, which is bad. And they say that. Well, at least Kevin Tsujihara says that. But the bad thing is he also says things like, well, teens need to get out of the house, and that's why they go to movie theaters. And movie theaters are a rich experience that won't be going away anytime soon. And if there's anything that I think is going to be going away anytime soon, it is probably a vast number of the movie theaters in America. They don't turn out frequently every week. They turn out for blockbusters. And they don't always turn out for every blockbuster, which we'll get to, I guess, in a minute. But it is a very risky business, and it's not a growth industry to operate a theater right now. So I don't know why he was stressing that point, that theaters are incredibly important, because the box office, while being a lot of money, is not stable. And is not a situation where it's going to grow tremendously from this point on. It is really going to be about home video and internet distribution, either through purchasing a digital license to media or through streaming services. Anyway, I'm not going to bore everybody else with the rest of the details, but please go read Recode Media's Code Media. The slash and the bracket things. Just go read their little interview thing in the show notes. It is worth your time, just because you'll feel kind of bad that this is the way that we're just going to stick to our guns on this as a society moving forwards. It's particularly sad because Warner Brothers was behind the wonderful movie we're going to discuss today, the very nice Edge of Tomorrow. And I think that this is definitely a case where it was a blockbuster that had underperformed and it didn't meet anyone's expectations. And the theater certainly didn't save it, and home video certainly hasn't saved it. You know, word of mouth has been incredibly strong, but it hasn't done anything to counteract the marketing, or I think maybe even, dare I say, the perception of casting Tom Cruise in a movie.
No, that's just your bias.
It just be my personal bias. But whenever I see Tom Cruise, I'm just like, ugh, Tom Cruise, ugh.
I thought he did quite well in this film.
Oh no, I agree. I will completely. Without any qualifiers, I will say that Tom Cruise did a brilliant job in this film. He was perfectly cast for this. I think the perception of what Tom Cruise can bring to the table from his prior performances in the 2000s has really damaged, I think, his quote unquote star power, the lure that he brings in terms of marketing. Basically all of his other Tom Cruise movies haven't really done as well as they should have, you know?
I'm not sure I know exactly the sentiment you're trying to express, but I guess there is a certain stigma that comes with it. Well, stigma is the wrong word with a Tom Cruise movie, because it's a Tom Cruise movie, but
I think
this one had enough going for it outside of just being Tom Cruise. I mean, I look at Tom Cruise cast in a film as a guy who's generally not going to screw it up, and he's going to give a solid performance, whatever the story may be. I don't know that I look at him in a... I don't think his being cast in a role has a downside in my mind.
Okay. There are a lot of people who have very strong feelings about his personal life that they bring to the movie theater, so that's baggage, really. Then there's also the whole situation of him being in things like Night and Day, which was also a box office bomb, where he can't...
Night and Day isn't just necessarily Tom Cruise's fault.
No, I'm not just saying it's... Okay, this is the part that I'm trying to stress. It's not his fault, and I think he did a good job in Edge of Tomorrow. I'm just saying that his the brand power, because remember, brand is a promise, the brand power of Tom Cruise's name on something isn't what it once was. That is all I'm saying. His movies have been underperforming in like the last 5 years, like in terms of drawing people to the box office. So
didn't Ghost Protocol do pretty well though?
I think it did okay, but I think it still didn't do as well as the previous Mission Impossible before it.
That's possible. Oblivion was a weird one. I mean, a lot of people have very opinions on that one.
Yeah.
It had some good things, bad things. But, you know, like Tropic Thunder was, I guess, a little, what was it, 6-7 years ago. But it was kind of downhill from there, wasn't it?
Well, I don't even fault Tropic Thunder with that. But the, you know, it really just comes down to being Oprah's fault, I think. When... No, I'm just kidding. I don't know. But I
understand what you're saying with like his personal life bleeding into his on-screen perception, but maybe this is me, but so much of that stuff is still just an enigma to me, that he is just beyond comprehension, that I kind of just take his character on screen at face value because there's no way I could possibly understand how weird this guy is.
Yeah, no, I have no idea the details of his life or anything. This is not a gossip show. I'm just saying that the public at large seems disenchanted with him. And in North America specifically, his movies have had a very weak domestic box office, even though they do better, or, well, not better, but they perform higher overseas than they perform domestically. And I don't know if that is from damage that he has previously caused from his previous PR shenanigans, from whenever... I think it was like his sister or something was in charge of his PR for that brief weird period. So, you know, who's to say? But I'm just saying that it is one of those things that might keep people away from this movie. And in many of the articles you might find about why Edge of Tomorrow didn't perform well, you will see that possibly cited as an explanation. I don't think that is the only thing that has kept people away, because I also think the marketing for the movie was not very convincing to get people into the theater. And you can see some of that in how they changed the title, and they walked back the change they made to the title after it was released, and they went to the home box office. Because, like, you go to Rotten Tomatoes, and it's not Edge of Tomorrow. It is Live, Die, Repeat, : Edge of Tomorrow. That is what it is under there. Because they have tried to turn that slug line from the marketing stuff into the actual name of the movie, because they're trying to push away the Edge of Tomorrow name, not really meaning anything and not really pulling people in. It's very weird. And even on like the box packaging, if you were one who was going to buy a disc, it still says Live, Die, Repeat, and does not say Edge of Tomorrow on the box. It is very strange how they go about, how this has all gone down with the marketing for this stuff. And I point out that this is strange precisely because I think this is a good movie. And I think that it has been done a disservice by marketing and I don't know, maybe by the media. I think that there's a very strong case to be made for why this should be in all of the award shows this season, for visual effects, if nothing else. But it has received almost no recognition for that. it's been kind of a disappointment.
Yeah, this is one that seems at kind of every step of the way. I mean, you forwarded me the Wikipedia article, which I hadn't read before, listing all of the production issues they had with extended schedules, and presumably that had to do with why the budget ended up being around $180 million for production, which that combined with the marketing failures and, you know, maybe preconceived notions going in. I didn't even realize this was based on a book when I first saw it. But all of that, in spite of itself, still managed to create a damn good movie. I mean, I saw this in theaters with my dad because he's an action movie kind of guy when this was out. And I was pleasantly surprised. And watching it again just earlier today, I really liked it. Again, I didn't really have much issue with it, especially once you try and wrap your head around some of these time loop issues, which you're going to have in any time loop movie. But this is actually a really good movie. And yeah, I am surprised that this didn't get really any mention. I almost forgot that this was a 2014 movie. But yeah, there are a lot of things that this movie had against it, and generally speaking, it probably was considered a failure because it, what, made barely twice its money back, which is generally considered breaking even in a Hollywood movie, which is insane.
Oh, no, well, it initially did not make twice its money back. Initially, the box office for, I think, the first couple months was $220 million, according to what I had read somewhere. And considering it was a $175 million budget, which does not include marketing costs, and marketing costs generally run, on average, 50% of what the movie costs to make. Or in some cases, 100% of what you spent on the movie is what you spend on marketing. So $175 million is an astronomical budget for a film. So the burden that places on you in order to recoup that, in addition to generating a profit, it's insane. So I think that is one of those situations where perhaps, you know, the expense of this is really what wound up doing it in terms of what we view as in terms of what the media might portray as a success. Because if this had been a $100 million movie and it pulled in $220 million, then everybody would have been like, oh, wow, that's crazy. Great job. But the fact
that I still don't know that they would have said, great job. That's just barely making a little bit of money. They're really looking to, I mean, that's the reason they sink $200, $250 million into movies these days, is because they think they can get $800, $900 billion back on them. But this is not even close to that range.
The whole thing was just kind of sad. Because, you know, it wasn't too long ago where this budget would have been unheard of for making it, and this budget and the profit for it would have also been unheard of for returning that kind of investment in a couple of months. But it's just, you know, not the same kind of environment we live in.
Yeah, frankly, it's shocking that they let the production grow the way it did. Just that one bit where it was talking about the beach scenes were originally scheduled for 2 weeks and ended up taking 3 months. I don't know how at that point it wasn't yanked out of Doug Liman's hands, because, I mean, there's always going to be overages and there's always going to be reshoots for stuff, but like what, six times as long to shoot a sequence? Yep. That's insane.
Yeah, and it is one of those things where I think Doug Liman's directing in the final product of this is good, but I cannot imagine the number of takes that must be on the cutting room floor for this. And in terms of creating a viable product that you can make and then continue to make things, you know, going forwards, it is kind of detrimental to have this albatross of your production budget hanging on you the whole entire time. But this is not just a problem for this movie. I mean, think about another earlier film that we had reviewed, another box office blockbuster, World War Z, which was in production hell for all kinds of issues that delayed everything, and there was whole reshoots of things. I mean, it is one of those crazy things where you're just like, this is how does something get so off the rails? Now, in contrast to World War Z, I think this is an amazing movie, and I think World War Z is a piece of crap. But it is so strange, and it sets up such a it sets the bar so high on what they have to do in order to overcome it that it really hurts them. And it is one of those things where it's just like, you can say, you know, artists should be allowed to do whatever they want to, but I think this is one of those situations where producers need to also be able to exert proper control over the situation, so that there aren't huge delays, so that there aren't giant budget overages, there aren't, you know, I mean, because this all rolls downhill too, because it affects everything that happens for the rest of the film. It affects when editorial happens, it affects when DI happens, it affects the VFX, it affects everything. So it is sort of one of those situations you can highlight and say, you know, creative authority is great, but, and the final product is great, but there must have been some way that the excess of this production didn't need to happen. So I am just sort of baffled by it.
Well, the one thing that kind of ties these two movies together, World War Z and Edge of Tomorrow, is both based on a book properties, and both, I believe that was the case in World War Z. They both began production without a finalized script, or at least World War Z rewrote their script while they were shooting. So maybe that has something to do with it. I don't know. When you talk about producers stepping in to sort of, you know, exert some sort of control over the production itself, I still don't know how we're going into production on more than $100 million movies without a finalized script. I don't know how that happens. I know we have release schedules and that sort of thing, but at this day and age, when your entire studio's future could rest on one major expensive flop, I don't know how we're still greenlighting movies that don't have a finalized script. I know there's always going to be rewrites, but there was at least a decision in this because it was based on a spec script, to enter into production before they had finalized what was actually going to happen at the end of the movie, which is insane to me.
Yeah, well, but it's not just World War Z and Edge of Tomorrow that have had this situation where the third act isn't finished. There are a lot of films in the last, like, 5 years, especially. Not that it didn't happen before that, but the frequency of that for these very large budget things is kind of a lot higher than you would expect. So go look on the Wikipedia page of basically any production and look at the production notes section for when they started shooting and what they had in their hands and what they ended up doing, because it is sort of eye-opening. The situation here where they didn't have the ending nailed down is not good. This is after they had already done basically the same thing on going into production on World War Z. So I don't know why Warner Brothers wouldn't have hesitated and, you know, pulled back to wait to start until they had fixed it, finalized it. But I guess it's kind of a good thing they didn't, because, you know, you just ran through a lot of beach scenes before then, in your shooting schedule.
I don't think, you know, shooting without an ending is something that we can really let them off the hook for. But for the for stuff in the time loop, I'm willing to grant, at least in this movie, a little bit of leniency with realizing they were in over their heads, because, you know, just like with any time loop movie, or let's just look at Groundhog Day, because it's another time loop movie with a female lead named Rita. There are a lot of different ways to shoot the same scene, and mixing it up and, you know, looking at it from different angles is kind of the whole point of that time loop. And maybe once you're in there, you're looking around to try and find the different angles on things, that you really discover what the scene is about and where it needs to go. But outside of the time loop, like montages, like what, there's like four or five different montages in here that are all going to be shot from slightly different angles because the characters are doing different things. Outside of that, I don't know how you really do any of this stuff where you have any, I don't know how you know where to start without having this all laid out on paper ahead of time.
Yeah. Well, according to Wikipedia, Doug Liman had a film workshop style approach to the beach scene. So I can't speak to what that means, but it does seem that 3 months is a long time. So,
Workshopping what? A scene like the beach scene is a terrible idea, especially when you have explosives and riggers and green screen, and it's every little bit of it needs to be choreographed. Just sort of showing up with cameras and crew and saying, like, let's see where this day goes. It's not really a great idea when you have to worry about where your actors are to avoid explosions.
Yeah. But let's move past this, because I feel like we have already iterated over this particular point. Let's get into it, because both of us really like this film. Regardless of the production difficulties and how we feel the movie might have been marketed and why it might have underperformed or not have received the acclaim it deserved, let's actually talk about why we think it deserves that acclaim. And I would like to start, first of all, with the opening to the film, which is not something I feel it deserves any acclaim. So that's
the
a good
montage.
Way to start. Yeah, we have the traditional rudimentary news broadcast clip, staticky montage of how the world ended, which is a tradition spanning many generations of filmmakers, apparently.
They also did that in World War Z, if I'm not mistaken.
They did it in World War Z. They did it in Snowpiercer. They did it in... It happens a lot.
Although Dawn they did the take the extra half step in this one to green screen some of their actors into some of the footage to make it look like some of the footage actually included their characters to tie it together. So it wasn't just completely disassociated.
Yeah, except I think it was kind of weak. But it does...
It was.
It does... Let's move past it, because it's over real quick. It is just there to barely set up the fact that an asteroid hit somewhere in Central Europe, and it unleashed this alien thing. Now, unfortunately, no one ever spells out why they're called mimics, that I am able to figure out. They don't seem to mimic anything, because they seem completely alien. So that is a weird name to give them.
I think there was a little bit in that montage where one of the newscasters mentioned that they're able to anticipate our moves before we even do them, something like that. I don't. That doesn't fully explain why they're called mimics, but yeah, that's about as much as you get, I think.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. Anyway, it's their name, and the we set up that Tom Cruise is a talking head for the military to go on these shows. Reassure the public, wearing his uniform, that everything's under control, that they have the best technology, the best minds, the willpower to see this through. And then the very first scene we get of him is him asleep in the helicopter landing in London. And he exits the helicopter, talks to a lady, and then she escorts him to talk to the general. Who's played by Brendan Gleeson. And, you know, he's like, you're a soldier, Harry. And so he's trying to recruit him into actually being on the front lines in this to cover it for them. But Tom Cruise is a coward. And it works really well here in the scene, I have to say. He plays a very convincing coward. As Major William Cage. Now, it doesn't... The one thing that I'm not entirely clear on why Brendan Gleeson kept pushing to have him on the front lines, other than maybe he was hoping he would just die at this point, because he was just so repulsed by the fact that he wouldn't participate. That is the only conjecture that I can offer for how dead set he is on this, because it doesn't seem like he's actually going to get any technical expertise from him. It seems like he just wants this punk to die.
Now I get what he was saying, where he wanted him out on the front line so he can help spin the war to the media as them doing the right thing. Or, you know, what does he say? There's going to be a lot of people are going to die, and when those coffins start heading home, they're going to be looking for somebody to blame, and I need you to spin that as we're doing the right thing. But if this really is like the Earth-ending invasion by aliens that are coming down to destroy us and take over the world, like, I don't think anyone's going to really blame anyone for, like, lack of foresight, because it's like, who's the guy who's really got the plan that's going to succeed against, like, let's just assume random aliens come down. How are we going to win? Like, I don't think they're really thinking that through. So I don't think the public would hold him responsible for that kind of thing. But you are right that at a certain point when Tom Cruise tries to blackmail his way out of the situation, he's just kind of like, yeah, we're going to throw you into the whole thing and we're going to call you a deserter and we're just going to cross our fingers that you get killed pretty quickly.
Yeah, it seems excessive. But fortunately, it sets in motion the events of this film, where he gets tased and then he wakes up at Heathrow, which has been converted into a military outpost to send the United Defense Forces over to mainland Europe. To the continent, as they say.
Before I forget, I did hear in an interview, I think it was when Tom Cruise was on the Nerdist podcast, but you know the helicopter landing in that fancy square in London there in the beginning? Mm-hmm. I think he said they did that because he just really wanted to do that in a movie, and they finally got permission to, and I think he said he ruined the first like three takes because he was smiling so big because he was having fun landing a helicopter in the middle of that square.
Yeah, speaking of production overruns.
Yeah, exactly.
But anyway, this is an important moment when he wakes up because we will see this again. it sets up his entry point in the loop that he's going to experience. Now, why it's this particular moment and not like a minute after or something, it's not really clear. But he goes through a whole thing with Bill Paxton, who plays Master Sergeant Farrell, and he is, I have to say, amazing in his role here, in a way that I didn't think Bill Paxton could be. He pulls this off quite effectively. And for those who are not familiar with Bill Paxton's treasure trove of work, I will refer you to Aliens and, of course, to Twister. But the
that's it.
Yeah, just those two, only those two. And if you have to choose between the two of them, only Twister. But I'm just kidding. Please don't. But the it's a really good performance turned in here. We set up the fact that he doesn't believe him. We set up the weird mixed crew that he's in. Where there seems to just be a bunch of people from random countries thrown in together. And they are, you know, playing poker and have to eat their poker cards. Or at least I'm assuming it's poker. It might have just been some sort of weird, you know, card betting game. Or maybe the whole point of the game is, like, if you get caught, you have to eat the cards. And then whoever eats the cards, I don't know, they bet on the thing.
Pretty sure it's poker because Tom Cruise points out that somebody had was working on a flusher at some point, and that's how he uses his knowledge of the future to prove that he is who he is, and they still don't believe him.
Well, I guess they just flushed that opportunity down the drain. No, but we also had in the opening news montage the inkling that there were robot suits. And we get introduced to those robot suits, where Tom Cruise is stuck in his and does not really actually know how to use it, even though he was on TV talking about how great it is. So, you know, he was not paying close attention to the operational instructions, I suppose.
He's just hitting the bullet points in the speech, just saying, hey, look, with these suits, you can kill hundreds of bad guys with a single person, because they're using Rita as an example of somebody who has already done that in their first major battle.
Yes. And it's a good example because they don't know that she had a slight upper edge. But the whole thing transpires where he's panicked and doesn't know what to do, and all he knows are the talking points of his presentations, which are completely useless to him. His pleading to be let go has not gone over well with anyone. He doesn't even know the safety on his gun works, and he's loaded up onto some sort of a drop ship along with other people.
It couldn't be worse for him. He's basically been labeled a liar and a con man. So basically anything he says to anybody at the base is not going to be believed. They think he's just a soldier trying to get out of his duty, but he really has no idea what he's doing, which you would think maybe if he doesn't know how to use the safety, he would probably be more of a threat to his fellow soldiers than like a use. Like they seem to just like let him die on his own or whatever. But a guy running around with all those grenades and weapons, like who doesn't know how to use it, I would be a little worried about standing next to him. But it is kind of hilarious how quickly he dies in this first scene.
Well, it is, I have to say, tactically unsound, basically, to punish someone like this. Because you're also wasting these supplies, which I have to assume are in some way limited. It seems sort of strange to sort of spitefully stick him into a robot suit that you might not have that many of and load him up with ammunition and explosives that you might not have that many of and then have him wander around on a battlefield and still something kills him. It doesn't seem like sound punishment.
They're probably not thinking too far ahead, though, because they've got guys duct taping claymore mines to their suits, which means they're probably not the most sophisticated in terms of bringing along just what they need. They're just basically bringing everything they possibly can all at once.
Yeah, well, this is one of those things that wasn't clear to me, is how battle-hardened are the rest of the squad. Like, what exactly have they... What action have they seen?
Well, the one gentleman has been arguing that he has been through 20 different battles, and the rest are saying, you're full of crap, so... presumably, the majority of the squad has been through less than 20 battles. I think you can assume that they've all been through at least one. Maybe that big one. I can't remember where they said where Rita did her thing. Yeah, there you go. But I don't know. It seems to be, although being an unwise decision to give him all of this equipment, if he does indeed die in his suit, as we will see in a couple scenes, you can just walk up and just take the equipment off of his suit and go about your business. So he's basically just like an equipment person carrying along some stuff until he dies, and then you just take it from him.
Yeah, that seems wise, instead of just dropping it. So things do not go well on the dropship. And unfortunately, they are hit, and there's an explosion, and they all have to get off in a really panicked way.
The bad guys knew they were coming, and yeah, they're all screwed.
Yeah, and the dropship dropping part here is actually pretty intense for what it is, because you get the sense that it's not clear exactly how well it's going to go even once they're off of this thing. And indeed, it does not go well for all of them, because some of them immediately die when they jettison from their harnesses, and some of them descend and get tangled up and then die. And then other ones, you know, land on the beach and then get hit by a crashing plane. So it is rough going. I
thought it was an interesting spin on sort of the chaos, because this is obviously meant to mimic the World War II attack on the beach at Normandy, but just that utter chaos, especially with, you know, the boats coming in Saving Private Ryan, where even if you make it off the boat, you're not guaranteed to, you know, make it through the water because you've got your equipment weighing you down. Just that utter chaos of the beach in Saving Private Ryan, just sort of reimagined in a way where, let's assume we've got these robot suits and we've got these dropships bringing everyone in. What are the most insane ways that this could possibly go wrong, and we end up with a fraction of a percentage of our guys actually on the beach, but it's the best we can possibly do because such is the nature of this kind of war. I thought they did a good job of illustrating the just disastrous chaos.
Yeah. And as hard of a time as we gave him for his, you know, spending six times as long as he was supposed to on this, this initial beach scene is incredibly disorienting in a very intentional way, where we as the audience can feel it is not clear what is happening. It is not clear what's killing them. People are just dying left and right. There's explosions, there's sand, the camera's moving, but it's not doing that stupid shaky thing where it just vibrates. And it is fluid, and you feel like you're propelled through as things keep happening. And we are introduced for the first time. Tom Cruise's character is introduced for the first time to Emily Blunt's character, Rita. They cross paths very briefly, and she seems none too impressed. Unfortunately, she's killed. And then he's left by himself to wander around until he runs into Mimics himself and with his squad, and then there is the Alpha Mimic. And I have to say, I was really genuinely impressed when I saw these Mimics. I think they move in an incredibly interesting way. They are unlike any alien design I can think of from other films, either practical or CG. The way they move is integral to their design. So you can't ignore the animation of them. And it's not one of those situations where you could say, like, oh, a stop motion puppet would have been better. You know, if you think that, then just shut your face because you're an idiot. But they also
have this sort of terrifying, like, mouth open at all times, just like flame shooting out of it thing going on, where they kind of look like an animal, but they also have those like robotic tentacles that they are lightning fast and just utterly menacing the entire time.
Yeah, and it really has to do with, if you look at them, the center body will stay sort of anchored, and then the tentacles will lash out onto things and through things and around things, and the thickness of the tentacles will shift from one tentacle to another while they're anchored in the same spot. It is really interesting, especially when they get into that really frantic mode where they're just sort of like lashing out in all directions, and it just is sort of like a really fast popping motion between the different tentacle positions. And they have a, like you were saying, that energy core that comes from sort of the center mouth area out through the limbs, through the it sort of spreads out through them. It is a really interesting design, and stills and the trailers don't really do it justice. And the Alpha, which we are introduced to here, expands on that, where it has more of a head than the other guys, the little orange mimics, do. Although we don't know what's called an Alpha, it's just a blue one. Whatever. So you see the blue one, and you immediately get the sense that, hey, maybe the giant blue one might be important, since there's so many of these little tiny orange ones, and this one is a different color, and is a different size, and it moves slower. So that is some sort of an indication. And Tom Cruise manages to die, and also take it out, and then its blood gets on his face, and then it does the weird melty entangling thing, and then he wakes up again, exactly where he was the day before, on the sacks in Heathrow, being woken up to be taken away. And he has to relive that same day over and over and over and over and over again, a la Groundhog Day. And he keeps dying over and over and over again, but not the same way, and not by an Alpha. All of his other deaths are just with regular drones or with accidents. Rita is always there, and it varies how she dies, and sometimes she doesn't, sometimes she sort of kills him, like taking his battery back. So it is very weird at first until we finally get that moment where he has lived through it enough times to anticipate several actions that the creatures take, and she is able to understand and is impressed by that, and then she kills both of them and says, "Come find me when you wake up."
Yeah, I love that moment. First of all, like the first time he dies and he gets the mimic blood all over his face and he's like basically melting with it, I was genuinely surprised by that because it was rather graphic. And I think the first time I saw this, I had no idea that there was a time loop element to this movie. Go figure, I had managed to avoid all that stuff. But I do like how savvy Rita is and how quickly she recognizes that he is doing things that no person should be able to do without this sort of time loop ability. So she pretty quickly just says, like, no, we're not going to fight. I'm going to stand here and let this this plane blow up and kill us both, because you're going to come find me tomorrow and we're going to start over, because I actually we can plan something if we know that this is the way it's going to go. But I'm just happy that somebody else has this ability now. I had it before, and she immediately recognizes what's going on and tries to leverage it, saying, just come find me tomorrow.
Yeah, only it's not exactly that tomorrow, because he's not able to get away on his first attempt from his platoon, his troop. Squad
montage number two.
Yeah, and this is all about him trying to get away from his squad. Now, one of the things we didn't know from the previous time loops, which I think is actually kind of interesting that Lyman does this way, because you know, Ramus, and it sort of like when he did Groundhog Day, set up like how the general day structure went, beginning to end. And here, Lyman had apparently like skipped over several probably less interesting parts, such as them, you know, marching on, you know, jogging around the Heathrow area that they're in, the campground area,
the PT segment that we hear about, but we don't actually see on his first day.
Yeah, so we didn't need to see it. I think it is wise that we didn't. But you know, it's one of those differences where when I saw it on that loop, I was just like, oh yeah, they went and did this thing. I forgot because he had already, you know, gone through a couple loops and we hadn't seen it. I found it kind of hilarious that, you know, when he rolls away that first time underneath the truck and dies, because it's sort of impressive when it gets through into the middle of the truck and then he rolls again. It doesn't work out so well.
Yeah, you can tell he's done the PT at least once or twice because he knows that he's going to have to do some push-ups for, you know, mouthing off to Bill Paxton. But then this is the first time he's tried to roll underneath the moving trucks and he misses so badly on the roll out and gets run over. And I love that Bill Paxton is just utterly horrified and walks over and goes, what the hell were you thinking? And he's just looking at Tom Cruise's mangled body on the asphalt, apparently.
Yeah. Well, and like Groundhog Day, it's one of those situations where it's like, wait, did the day keep going even after he died? That's kind of weird.
I think he didn't die right away. I think he got mostly run over and maybe died a few seconds later.
So like one eye was still flickering or something.
Yeah, maybe he just got torn in half.
Oh yeah, maybe. Although that would be kind of interesting if each one of these loops was actually a separate timeline. So that'd be fun, you know. But he finally manages to get to Rita, and she's doing some sort of a weird training thing. And now this is one of those things where I have sort of a bone to pick with the movie, where I did not find that this method of training it didn't seem like it made sense that they were able to set this up and enact this in the way that they did in the film, in the amount of time that they had and with the resources that they had. The spinning blade things seem ill-advised if you have a limited number of personnel and armor. And these spinning blade things also don't really move like human devices that we have. And while the robot suits are not things that we have, they seem sort of grounded in the technology that we have, whereas these spinning blade things do not. So I'm not terribly won over by the spinning blade things or the whole idea of like you walk through onto this course and then they'll just keep spinning and possibly kill you.
Well, the spinning blades are clearly meant to mimic those gigantic, like auto industry robots that move very quickly and very precisely. But we do see there are two of those courses when he first walks in. And on the one side, there are a bunch of people standing on the outside of that line, shooting at the robots spinning around, just trying to figure out how to actually kill something that moves that quickly. And then on the other side, we see Rita has one entirely to herself, and she's out there in the middle of it. I don't think they're actually designed for people to be out there where she is. She's just a crazy person and she can do whatever she wants. The rest of those people are using it as like a shooting range and just like trying to kill them with their guns. So it is true though that they clearly have been studying the enemy long enough to realize that they could build this sort of mock version of the mimics into robots, which I'm not sure where they would have come up with that idea, but I think it is supposed to be used as a shooting range, and Rita is just kind of a crazy person and running around out there because she's unkillable, apparently.
Yeah, well, and also with the blade things, it doesn't make any sense why you'd use live ammunition on something that is a spinning metal thing.
So
that
metal,
just have ricocheting automatic bullets going every direction. She's finally convinced they finally meet under these circumstances, and she's convinced that he knows enough that she's going to go take him to this other guy. And then she explains that she used to have the power that he has right now, and that the other guy can help explain it. And obviously he is a discredited scientist who just happens to work on this particular base doing machine stuff and is familiar with her situation. So,
and this scene, writers of Snowpiercer take note, is a gigantic exposition dump, but it comes at the end of the first act, not the end of the movie.
Yes. And also take note that it seems to integrate with several of the things we have seen so far, so it is not like a complete surprise. The only thing that's surprising about this is that they have really intricate hologram technology at this point in our future.
Right. Well, I mean, how else are you going to design that robot suit? He's got to have the hologram.
Yeah, table. Yeah. I don't know. It's one of those things where it's just like they could have just shown it on a TV. Like this is a little CSI Miami, guys. Dial it back. And
maybe
so,
it fell off of a derelict alien ship. Wait, no, it's probably a different series of movies, isn't it?
Yes. And so, for some reason, he has really articulate renders of the different kinds of aliens, the different kinds of mimics, as well as a very interesting and detailed render of something that no one has ever seen before, which is the Omega.
Rita saw it in her imagination.
Yeah, and then she perfectly recounted it to him.
Or maybe he used one of his weird metal pin type devices to extract it from her memory.
Yeah, his steak cuber, like cube steak. I mean, whatever that was.
That was a funny moment though, that when she first picked that up and like extended the spikes and goes, let's use this on him. And the guy's just like, put that down. That doesn't work. And Tom Cruise is clearly like, what are you people doing back here?
Yeah. Well, and that was one of those things where we didn't get exposition of what that was and we would get that later. But we saw it teased enough that when we saw it later, then it made sense. It wasn't like a total surprise that they had an alien detection device.
I like that it was hidden under a comedy moment too, where it's just like, well, that doesn't work. Put that over here. Lest you think we're a crackpot.
Yes. And I like the how many fingers am I holding up behind my back thing, because that turns out to be kind of funny. But the explanation here is all based on inferences that she's had from her loops. And it makes sense that she is able to build up enough data from repeated loops, and also from the induced delusions or, you know, dreams that she has from the Omega, that she's able to relay this information, and they can construct this. However, if they kept repeating the same day over and over and over and over and over again, then why would he believe her explanation, assuming they'd only met one day ever?
I'm not sure I follow. How do you mean? The scientist guy?
Yeah, I mean, if she kept reliving the same day in Verdun over and over and over and over and over again, then he would not have been outside the timeline to notice that as well. He would have been in the time loop, so he would have only seen her in that loop once.
Presumably she could have done the same guessing the fingers behind your back kind of thing, but she did say he's the only one who will believe you, and I guess we're just sort of glossing over whatever hoops she had to jump through to convince this guy that she was reliving the same day over and over again. Although I'm not entirely sure why she knew to go to him in the first place. Maybe he was a scientist before she ran into him and he was discredited because of the crazy things she was saying.
Yeah, it's not clear. It's not important though, so let's move past. I just thought it was worth bringing up that, you know, we're it is one of those things that we are given here that we have to accept in order to keep moving through the plot. And
yeah,
I think
presumably
it is,
a man of science, when presented with the same sort of things that Tom Cruise did to Bill Paxton, would get more than just a dumb look on his face and then go back to your bunk. He would get some sort of, maybe we should talk about this for a little bit because there's something clearly interesting here.
Yeah, and they do. And so it becomes all about this plan to get off the beach, to somehow manage to get away from everybody else in the invasion, get past all the aliens, past all the mimics, and then go find the Omega and kill it. even though they don't know where it is yet. But but she assures him that he'll eventually have a vision about where it is.
And it's kind of funny that she's so like relaxed about it, because she knows it's going to take him 50, 100, 200 times of trials on the beach before he figures out how they're actually going to get off the beach. So she's like, let's just worry about that for now. You'll get to your visions later, but let's just try and worry about not dying. And that'll be our next series of montage
Sorry. Scenes. We're skipping the training.
We can't skip the one major plot point that we learn right at the end of that, which is the blood transfusion problem.
Oh, yes. There's the blood transfusion problem where she had this power until she received the transfusion because she was knocked unconscious but not killed. And that once she had this transfusion, the blood was out of her system somehow, and then she wasn't able to do this thing anymore where she would loop through time. She acknowledges that the Omega let them win at Verdun in order to sort of like further ensnare them, I guess, either that or to get her knocked out and recovered so that they do the transfusion and get her out of the loop. It doesn't matter. That's the reason why they won at Verdun had nothing was related to her having the powers, but also related to her losing the powers, which is why she is sort of cold and hard here, because she's died quite a few times, and she's not terribly sympathetic for his particular situation. She just sort of mechanically accepts what he needs to be doing, and expects him to live up to that, which is difficult for him because he's just a cowardly jerk.
He's a cowardly jerk with a tool that they can use, so they're going to use it. So put on your big boy boots. We're going to go fighting, and that's just going to be the way it's going to be, because it doesn't matter. You're going to die. You're going to be able to do it over and over again.
Yeah, and they do the training montage where she's going to train him, and then he keeps getting injured in her reckless training, which doesn't really matter since they can just reboot, in a manner of speaking. And so she kills him a few times, just shoots him in the head.
I like that he tries to talk his way out of being killed every time. Like, he breaks his back, he breaks a leg. He's like, no, please don't shoot. Fine. He just finally accepts and gets shot in the head over and over and over again.
Yeah, he's like, oh, it's just my foot. It'll be better by tomorrow. And she's like, no, you got to be 100%. Otherwise, it's a complete waste. And then kills him. And it's just like, well, this is very, very severe recovery policy.
And he even tries to talk his way out of it by trying to transfer it to her with his not so subtle insinuation that maybe it can be transferred via sex. She's like, nope, sorry, tried that, and then moves right along.
I have to ask, though, since you brought that up, how did she try to transfer it with sex? Was she trying to transfer it from her with sex, or was she trying to go find another person who had experienced the alpha blood transfusion and was trying to have sex with that person? Whatever happened to that person?
I think this is a reference to what's the name of the gentleman later that we get a brief reference to? Hendrix or Henderson or what is it? One that she says she saw die 300 something odd times, which is basically the reversal of the situation it is here. I assume she found somebody else, the way Tom Cruise has found Rita, to help her out and actually believed her. And she tried to get him in on the loop along with her so they could both fight in the same sort of reset time ability. And she was not able to do that.
Yeah. And that also plays into part of it, because he was someone that she had feelings for. And, you know, I got to find out. Apparently Jeremy Piven was cut from this movie completely. Yeah,
I saw that in Wikipedia, which I could not possibly imagine what he would add to this movie or what scenes were removed.
This is one of those things where it's just like, I wonder if they had like flashbacks to like her Verdun stuff, and like he was the one that kept dying over and over again, and he was that person that she was in love with, in which case I'd just be like, ew, gross.
That would be really odd. I find him, he would add some more comedy to this whole thing as just one of the ridiculous squad leaders who kept blowing up, but I don't know what he would have added to this. And it was, he was added at the last minute too, wasn't he?
I don't know. He was apparently added and removed entirely. So, you know, good job, Jeremy Piven. You charming rogue. You got cut from a movie. Moving on. Then we start the montage of going through the beach over and over and over again, and him trying to explain to her every single time the moves that she needs to make when they get in there.
Right. They've moved on to the beach because he finally saw his vision of the Omega at the dam, and now she basically said, "Training's over. We're going to go do it for real now."
Yeah. And which I thought was very strange, because he's like, there were mountains, and it was in German, and it's just like, okay, that's so specific for continental Europe.
Well, we don't know how many dams are in Germany.
Or it doesn't even necessarily have to be Germany. There's other, it could have been in any number of other countries that either use German as a language or use it as a supplementary language. So, you know, it could have been Switzerland, but you know, whatever. We move past this. The other guy figures out where it is, and then every subsequent loop, he remembers where it is. They go to the beach. They keep perfecting how he can explain to her to get off the beach through going through the system. He eventually gets frustrated with this process, and this is sort of weird, because then in the following loop, he wakes up, and he just escapes, and he goes to London. And goes to a pub and just starts drinking. And then all the old people in the pub are calling him a coward.
I did think there was some decent humanity in this bit where, you know, we're on board with the montage. They've got to figure out their way through this. But you do see that it starts to wear on him that he's watching his partner, who is, you know, I don't know if you just want to call them partners in the sense of like cops working together or something. But he watches her die over and over and over and over again. And he's getting frustrated, endlessly frustrated. And he's kind of depressed by the whole thing. And he just says, screw it. I'm taking a day off and I'm going to go get a drink. And, you know, even once he realizes that he can't escape for a day to just go drink because the mimics wind their way up the river and attack him there, he just gets more and more angry and just generally pissed off because he's back in the training fighting the robots and just beating the living crap out of them and just generally unhappy. And it's really getting to him, and you can see it.
Yeah, well, I think this is one of those moments where he hadn't fully given up hope that he could get through this. Then he sort of like resigned himself to like, oh, it's not really worth it. If I just, you know, hang out over here, then what's the worst that could happen? And then he, you know, quickly comes to understand there's really no escape for him, that no matter what he does, the aliens will overwhelm the invasion. The mimics will come ashore on England, to England, and they will, you know, wreck jolly old England. And potentially the world. And so he can't just casually escape to the pub every day. He's got to put all of his effort forward into killing the Omega. And this sort of doubles his resolve that he had before in earlier scenes. He comes into it fresh. And this is when they make it past to they get to the little trailer park area. Caravans or whatever they call it. You weird Europeans. And then they get to the trailer park, and then, you know, they steal the minivan with the hitch trailer that he says to unhitch, and then, you know, the other thing, and then the mimics shoot out of the ground. And then they consolidate to one car, and then they make their way down the road before they realize a mimic was inside the trailer, and they expend their fuel packs and stuff, and they wander through cornfields, and then they get to a farmhouse, and they conveniently find helicopter, but there's no keys that are immediately apparent. And this is where I thought it was really interesting. Things start to really break down, where we're not sure how many times he went through this loop and got to this point, or if this is the first time he's been to this point. And he gets to here, and they have this moment in this exchange where she realizes this has happened many times and that he is actually stalling.
He tips his hand by knowing exactly how much sugar she wants in her coffee.
Yeah, she wants too much sugar, I have to say.
three sugars is too many?
Yeah, three sugars is a lot of sugar.
I mean, she's about to die. Let her have all the sugar she wants. Plus, she's working real hard every day. I'm sure she'll burn it off.
I know, but the carbs, for Christ's sakes, as Emily Blunt would say in a different movie.
I don't think she sounds quite like that, but sure.
Yeah, well, I can't do an Emily Blunt impersonation. And for those listening, if my previous references have gone completely over your head, please just go watch The Devil Wears Prada. Emily Blunt is in it, and she steals many of the scenes that she is in. Pretty much any scene Emily Blunt is in, she steals it. So go give it a watch.
And it is ostensibly a prequel to this movie.
Yes, exactly. Because she finally gets to go to Paris.
just under slightly different circumstances.
Yeah.
I think Fashion Week is kind of underwater, literally.
Yeah. Yep. And so, this is where, you know, he laments that no matter what he's done, she always dies. And he describes exactly how it's going to happen. And her reaction to this is not, oh, well, let's think of something else. Her reaction to this is, no, f*** this. We're going to do it. We're going to make sure this happens because I don't give a crap. You know, the situation has to go down. And of course, she dies, and it's really unfortunate. And he dies as well. But the next cycle, he doesn't take her with him. He goes and he does this by himself.
Yeah, because right in her dying moment there after the helicopter crashes, she has realized that he is going through the same terrible nonsense that she went through with her fella there, and she actually tells him the truth about her middle name as something that's actually honest, because you can see that she is kind of feeling bad, or she at least understands the emotional toll that this is taking on him. And once he kind of realizes that, you know, she kind of feels the same way, or has this empathy towards him with regard to, you know, losing this person they've spent so much time with, he just says, screw it, I'm going to do it myself. And I can get through this if I'm not trying to save her the whole time, which is kind of depressing because he's just walking through the beach and everyone is getting killed. You know, everyone from J Squad is just dying all around him. He's just saying, you know, this is what I got to do to get to the end of the road to make this whole thing stop, because it's just too depressing and painful.
Yeah, well, this is a sharp contrast to his earlier attempts of saving everyone. When in previous parts of the beach montage, he would save all of these people, like the guy who gets hit by the plane that crashes, and the squad that gets surrounded in that little like pit area in between dunes. But he doesn't bat an eyelash about any of this stuff. He has a mission, and he's going to go on it. And if they're dead, then so be it. So if this is permanently ensconced in the timeline, then it's going to be, you know, permanently ensconced in the timeline. Big deal. He goes through to take the helicopter and flies the helicopter to the dam. And this is important because it's Trep. that didn't work out very well. It seems that the Omega somehow has some way to send him images of it inside of the dam in this specific spot, even though it is not there, and that it lured him to this location where another Alpha was standing by to kill him. And yes, he had been disarmed by the regular orange drone guy. But the drone wasn't going to kill him, because if the drone killed him, then it would have reset the day. But, if the Alpha gets him and, bleeds him out, then, you know, the Alpha will get the ability to shift time back from Tom Cruise's character. So Tom Cruise, in a very agile maneuver, drowns himself. And it manages to reset time and explain to Emily Blunt and What's-His-Face that this situation where they thought that this is where it was actually a trap, and that it must be somewhere else. And this is where they come up with the other plan, where, like you were saying, the funny pokey thing, they talk about that and how they actually need the real version that was taken from him, which the general has. And then they seem to go through this situation where they're going to go get it, and they break out of the base. They go there, and we are able to intuit from Tom Cruise's acting and his movements that he's been through this situation several times. But he explains it to Emily Blunt's character, of course, because each time she has not been through it. So, you know, it's like, oh, well, the guy with the yellow armband recognizes you each time, so turn away. You know, all that stuff. And then there's a little, like, dance maneuver they basically do as they go down the hall, where they're, like, popping in and out of the elevator and swirling around the guy as he turns his back and off to the general's office. And there's the whole thing with Iris and, like, her birthday, all that stuff. They're finally able to convince the general to give them the actual device. And it surprises even Tom Cruise, because this is, of course, the version of this timeline where he was able to do this for the very first time. And he doesn't really have a plan after this. So then there's a very dramatic escape for them.
Apparently they didn't convince the general enough to not get arrested as soon as they leave.
Yes. Well, I mean, in all fairness, if this had actually been the situation, then they wouldn't have been arrested, because they would have escaped, because they would have known it was coming. But they didn't know it was coming, which is why the general's plan succeeded.
But I'm still not entirely sure why he thought it was a good idea to stop them. Like, was there not enough convincing evidence in the whole thing, in his little spiel there, to say, like, just let this guy have this thing that I don't care about?
I don't know. It was pretty silly. So they, but on this loop, they're able to use the device very quickly and figure out where the Omega is. Unfortunately, they get into a car accident, and triple unfortunately, he has had a blood transfusion.
Wah, wah, wah.
Yeah.
You would think, since they made a big point out of this whole "you have to die, don't bleed out" thing, like, maybe they would have devised some sort of, like, grenade around a necklace that he would always wear under his shirt, so whenever he got into a tricky situation, he could just, like, yank a pin and blow himself up. Like, I would do that just to make sure I never got backed into a corner where I couldn't die.
That's thoughtful of you, Dan.
Booby trap myself.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Good plan. So they didn't have this foresight, unfortunately, and they no longer have the ability to change time. Or at least Tom Cruise has the incredibly awkward line of, "I can feel it. I can no longer have the ability." And I was just like, why did you have to say that? You could have just said, "I don't want to put it to a test."
Yeah, I can feel it. It's gone. Like, what do you mean? It's like you forgot to eat your spinach that day, so you don't have your Popeye strength or something? I don't get it.
Well, it doesn't make any sense, because before he couldn't feel anything on any of the other previous loops. Like, even the first loop, it wasn't like it was something special. So the line is just kind of silly. I don't think they needed that. It should have been abundantly clear that they just didn't want to kill him and then find out it didn't actually loop. So they break out. They go back to the base. And remember, this has all happened in that first part of the 24-hour cycle before it's night again, and they actually have the beach invasion. So in this time loop, the beach invasion hasn't happened yet, even though they've done a whole lot of stuff. And he is able to convince J-Squad that he knows enough of their personal details from his previous loops through the timeline for them to feel like he has the upper edge, and for them to go along with his plan to go take, like, what, 8 people and bust into Paris and go into the Louvre. So it's a very weird plan. I can't say this is particularly well thought out, and I have some serious questions about how they secure their aircraft at Heathrow. Because you could just take off in a very loud helicopter plane whenever you feel like it. And so they take off in their vertical takeoff and landing dropship, VTOLL, and they cross the channel, and they somehow fly over everything. But I guess nobody was. I guess the aliens weren't expecting anything because they were only expecting the invasion from previous time loops. So they managed to fly all the way to Paris. Without incident, before being shot down in Paris. It just seems like lax security. They crash, and they lose basically almost everything they have.
What, there's like four guys left over.
Yeah, and let's not to spoil anything, but there will very, very quickly be fewer than four guys left. You know, we get the whole scene of like Tom Cruise like almost drowning, getting out of the robot suit. They've got like basically nothing left to use. The mimics who shot them down apparently aren't too concerned about like actually going and sorting through the wreckage at this point, because I mean it's been like a long time, and they all circle back and meet at the ship.
They landed further away from where they were headed, so maybe the mimics took a little while to figure out where they landed.
Maybe. But the mimics didn't seem to cotton on to what was happening until they started up the prop engines for the crashed ship, so that they could go skim it over the water to the Louvre as far as it would take them, which, you know, is a decent plan. As a plan can go when you have absolutely nothing.
And of course it ends in a giant fireball of disaster as they crash into everything.
Well, not just that, but two more of the guys go kill themselves, which is not a good use of two guys when you have so few people. Cause this basically leaves them with one other guy who gets killed. And then Tom Cruise is manning the gunning thing and Emily Blunt is driving it. And that is not good. Cause you're just like, well, I know we're going to need these two. So basically no one else is going to die for the next couple minutes. Cause otherwise it's going to be kind of impossible to believe that Tom Cruise can get all the way down there by himself, but maybe they would have done it. I don't know. And so they get into the Louvre, they blow up the way they got in to keep out the mimics that were on the surface, but they very quickly discover that there is an Alpha lurking down there guarding the Omega.
Naturally.
Yes. I mean, if you were, you know, you got to have your Alpha and the Omega, you know, they go together like two peas in a pod. An alpha pod and an omega pod. One pod brings life and one pod brings death. But the... Well, no, that's not true. They both kill. But the... and actually, it doesn't make a lot of sense because technically the alpha would have been the omega and then the omega would have been the alpha because it's the thing that rebooted everything and gave everything life. If you were really going to go by this, but whatevs. So... Because it's not like they were using it for like alphabetical reasons, because it's not like it went like alpha, beta, gamma. No, they didn't care. But the Emily Blunt's like, yeah, right, you're not going to be able to take on the alpha. I'll deal with this situation as much as I can and draw him away. You go take all of these grenades and go blow up this thing. And unfortunately, I don't like this one part of the scene where they kissed. And I know that I sound like, you know, I don't know, Grumpy Joe, but it bugs me because I liked the situation much better when they were compatriots fighting through this. And even all of the other moments of like telling the middle names and stuff like that, like that is a moment where they're bonded beyond friendship, beyond love. And then in something like this, it's not the same for me where is very, very much about love. And while we have experienced his journey with her, she has not experienced a journey with him other than the events of the last couple hours. So her motivation here doesn't make as much sense either, because she also kind of initiates this kiss.
Yeah, I think it's another example of her recognizing in him the same sort of feelings that she had about the guy that she lost. And she realizes that, you know, when he's volunteering to let himself die while she goes and kills the Omega, the reason he's doing that is to try and protect her, even though it is not the sound plan because he is injured. And, you know, she basically says, look, that's not smart. I realize what you're doing here because you care about me, but that's not the way this is going to have to go down. I appreciate it. I can see that this is going to be difficult for you because you're going to have to watch me die one more time and you can't reset it, but that's just going to be the way this is going to be. So sorry. And, let's take care of this now.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I do like this part where she says there's no way either one of us makes out of this situation alive. Like, so, you know, don't be a punk. Like, don't think you're going to protect me. Like, I am no snowflake. We're going to go through this situation. Everything seems to be going off like as you would expect. She draws the Alpha away and, you know, she does her best with the situation that she has, and he stumbles into some water and he's got his grenades. And then the Alpha kills her, then comes after Tom Cruise and stabs Tom Cruise. But he, of course, has all of the pins from the grenade. Ha ha ha, LOL. The grenades sink in the water and then bounce on the surface of the Omega ball thing and into the crack in the Omega. Because that is an important defect of any spherical evil object, is to have just a giant crack that goes to the core.
A grenade-sized crack.
Yeah, or something that, you know, I mean, it's not exactly 3 meter across exhaust port, but it's close enough. The thing blows up, and rather than being killed by this 8-grenade explosion that occurred mere feet from him.
This incredibly large percussion that shot a fireball at the top of the Louvre?
Yeah, it was like an energy burst or something, because you'll see it like travel along the wall and then...
Right. That was the energy from the Omega basically sending out the push notification to all the other drones and alphas to die.
Push notification of death. No, yes, God, which is, you know, kind of another thing that doesn't seem like if this was a designed creature, which had all of these advanced tactical capabilities, why do all of them turn off? Like that is some Trade Federation droid, nonsense.
Well,
here.
The Omega is the brain. And if, you know, if your brain dies in the Matrix, your body dies outside the Matrix. That's how it works.
Okay, I'm glad we sorted all this out with important logic. And so they all die. They die in an interesting way where they sort of, like, I don't know, crystallize. And then Tom Cruise just sort of, like, drifts in the water where this explosion has happened, and the water's remarkably clear. And then some goo hits him and does the same stuff as before, only it's a lot of goo.
The blood from the Omega.
Yeah, the blood from the Omega, only it's a lot more blood than what had happened with the Alpha. And his eyes go black and stuff, and then he wakes up, but this time he wakes up on the helicopter from the very, very, very beginning of the movie, right after the opening PR montage, which is not where he would normally wake up in these loops. This is also unique for a couple reasons. One, because everything's hunky-dory now. He's still major. He hasn't been branded a deserter and sent to the camp. But instead of having to fight the aliens again, they've all mysteriously died in this time loop. Like, they were somehow, like, sort of, like, kicked out of the time loop in some way. And now there's just, like, desiccated husks of the aliens left or something. It's very strange. I don't know how this part... This is the confusing part of the movie. I'm fine with all of the loop logic prior to this. This part just is sort of, like, breaking my mind, where it's just like, well, it seems awfully convenient that all of this stuff has transpired in just this way, where all of the aliens have died, all of J-Squad is alive, he's alive, doesn't have his demotion... doesn't run in with the general and have his whole thing, but then still goes and meets Emily Blunt, and presumably they're getting on, getting it on later. But it kind of ends there, and it's just like, well, so that was convenient. Like, I thought this was really actually kind of pretty dark and brave up until that point, and then it's just like, well, so then you gave them all, like, the fairy tale happy ending where all of the bad guys were dead because the main bad guy died, and then everything was reset and everything was wonderful again, and the sun was shining. Like, it was sort of like sad in a way that, you know, we ended in a way where there weren't the repercussions that I would have wanted. And I don't know if that is a consequence of how there was no ending to this movie when they started shooting or something, or if that was, you know, studio note that it needed to end in a happy way because it was a summer blockbuster. Who knows?
No, I think this was Doug Liman's decision. And the first time I saw it, I will agree, I was confused about why he reset all the way back to being on the helicopter, which obviously had the ripple down effect of never having been arrested and all of that other fun stuff. Watching it a second time, and especially after reading that article on Screen Rant that you sent me, I buy the ending a whole lot more, and I'm not sure that I could do as good a job explaining it as that article did, but more or less that the mimics existed outside of the time loop, which is why they could remember all of the things that happened to them. So their death was their death. They're done after the Omega is blown up. And the reason Tom Cruise was reset was because the point in the time loop didn't exist anymore. I, you know, at this point, I shouldn't be trying to recollect that article you sent me, especially when I'm messed up in the head from cold medication. But it explained sort of a method by which the time loop sort of makes sense, where it actually resets to the actual beginning of his day, whether or not he did it by choice because he actually has the full control of the Omega or not. It works in a way that the timeline that existed before no longer exists, and he's starting over from the previous day. And of course, what's he going to do? He's going to go see Rita because he's sad that she died, but she's not dead, so happily ever after. He's going to go explain it to her. Presumably, it's going to take 3 weeks for him to actually explain what the hell just happened, and then they can be friends.
Yeah, hopefully he gets dissected or sent to an insane asylum. But the
I don't think he's telling anybody what actually happened. And the one thing that article did say, which I thought was pretty funny, is the first thing he better do is go get a blood transfusion so he doesn't get stuck in this time loop again.
Yeah. Which is another point that they make in that article, which I was about to also reiterate, is just that if he is contaminated with that blood, then he would just keep resetting everything theoretically, even though the Omega and stuff is destroyed. Like, when he first woke up in that helicopter, I thought, wow, this is kind of daring that they're going to have this day be so grim that he wakes up at the invasion further back and has to relive that. And then, you know, then I was quickly disabused of that notion. But I still stand by what I said, that I think that combined, everything's a little too happy at the end of this. Like, there's no loss or change in a physical sense. There is a mental loss and a mental change that Cruise will carry with him, and that Rita will carry with her still from her previous run-in with Verdun. The world itself is not, like, scarred or changed or moved in any particular way.
And maybe they could have found a better balance with that. But I think the one thing that in the Wikipedia article, it said, I don't know if it was Doug Liman or the writer, they said, by the time you get to that last scene, you're so fatigued with these multiple timelines with everyone dying and the trying over and over again and the different ways that everyone has lost everyone else, that it kind of needs to be a sort of straightforward ending to not, like, kick the audience in the crotch one more time. Like, I don't know. It is like the sunniest of all possible endings, but I think it's okay. It works for me.
Yeah. Okay. So, but I mean, you know, as quibbles go, I have very, very few with this movie. You know, there was the line that I felt was unnecessary about, like, feeling that he didn't have the power anymore. The silly design of, I think, the little spinny robot training guys, and then this happy ending. I mean, that's not a huge list of things that I have a quibble with about a movie. Like,
especially for a gigantic sci-fi war movie like this, where so many things could have gone wrong.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, and I think the effects are great, and I think it is a real shame that the movie is not nominated for more things. And I should say, disclaimer, I did work at Sony Pictures Imageworks while this was being made there, but I didn't work on it, so I don't owe anybody anything when I say that I like the look of it. I have no personal investment in that. But I think the creatures are really, really badass. It's something that I hope more people will see, and maybe it'll be a cult classic, who knows, on Ultraviolet.
No, I really like it. I plan to watch it again at least one more time. And when you talk about the effects work, I do remember, I was probably FX guy now that I'm thinking about it, there was some behind the scenes photos, since all that beach stuff was not location, that was actually set up at a studio. There was a ton of work that went into those beach scenes, and it looks awesome, especially, I mean, just beyond the characters. There was just so much work in this movie, and it all looks great.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, according to the article, I don't even remember if it was FX Guide or if I read this somewhere else, but it basically, they had a bunch of sand, and they set it up at the studio in London. Not in London.
I think it was, actually.
Oh, I thought it was like some suburb of London.
Oh, probably.
Yeah. It's all the same. It doesn't matter. Foggy London, British town. They kept having problems with the lighting being different from the wonderful weather they have on the island. You know, it's not the kind of thing you think of when you think of island weather. But they would get rain, and the sand would turn into sludge. So they had to make this look like it was the same every day. And they had to dry it out, basically. And they had to put green screens. Key things with green screens shot in daylight that I can imagine were probably not the cleanest, given the conditions and the camera work that is going on here. So the fact that that battle scene is not actually shot, you know, like Normandy or anywhere else on the coast of France, is actually pretty impressive, I think, when you take that all in together, given the level of detail that goes into it. And it's one of those things where you might not have anticipated that. You might anticipate that all of the alien stuff is, you know, phony baloney, and you might anticipate that the explosions and stuff like that is all inserted, but you might not expect that there wasn't really a beach that they were on.
Yeah, and a lot of rig removal, people on wires, things, you know, flying in and out of the frame. There's just a ton of work. Oh, I actually found the article right here. It is FX Guide. There are a lot of really cool before and after shots of what the beach scene looked like. I'm going to send this to you because it's really kind of cool.
Yeah. And like you're saying with the rigs, what was it? They weighed like 200 pounds or something when they would put these things on.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Don't forget that these people are in robot suits too. So
yeah,
they're not the lightest of people to just throw around on whatever set you've built.
Yeah, I mean, some of them they said were made out of lighter components, but then they had the ones that the primary actors were generally wearing close up to camera were not light as a feather.
Yeah, the thing I like about this behind the scenes on FX Guide is there's some like B-roll footage, not from the actual camera, that just sort of shows from a wide angle what the whole set looked like, and it is just as much chaos as you would have expected a set full of war on a beach would look like. And it's just like making that into a seamless final product that looked as amazing as it does is a huge undertaking.
Holy balls, look at that green screen.
Right, they're all like 100 yards away, and they're what, like 12 by 12 panels that are just kind of like stuck together.
Yeah, and like with shadows being cast from one panel onto another panel, and like these lumpy little like pillow sacks along the bottom of them.
Some of them have tracking markers, some of them don't.
Yeah, and then of course my favorite part is they are tall, but not tall enough when you are at certain camera angles. So like the cannon here in this one shot of the original plate is breaking the top of the green screen there. So that's
which
sad.
Doesn't matter though, because it looks like the cannon was replaced in CG anyway. So
yeah. Oh goodness.
Yeah, there's some really good work on this movie.
Yeah. And it is my recollection, I can't read this right now to be 100% sure, but it was my recollection that Sony did all of the beach stuff and all of the mimics, and that I think it was MPC or Framestore that did the Paris water stuff.
Well, there were nine different studios that worked on this, I believe. So we've got Sony Pictures Imageworks, Framestore, Cinesite, MPC, NCAM, The Third Floor, and Prime Focus.
Yeah. Well, Third Floor did all the previs, supposedly, which I have to ask, if you're shooting something for 3 months instead of two, any workshop style, I'm not sure the previs, I don't know how much that paid off, but hopefully they got their... Hopefully they got all they wanted out of it. But
there's just a substantial part of this movie that doesn't take place on the beach. So maybe that stuff was all properly previewed.
Yeah, because the robot things, I think I read somewhere, Cinesite did the spinny robot blade trainers. Yeah. So everyone go look at this thing too, because it's effing neat. Oh, and they even talked to Dan Kramer, who was the VFX supervisor at Sony Pictures Imageworks, and who I follow on Twitter, and who almost never talks. So if you're interested in following a VFX supervisor, but you are worried about being inundated with as many tweets as like someone like I tweet, then don't worry. Dan is very quiet.
One last thing to mention on this: this was shot on film. This was shot on film.
Yes, 35mm film.
Boy, we should ask your friend what that was like, because I would not want to shoot this type of project on film, personally.
Mm-hmm. I don't think it was up to him.
No, I think he might have some insight as to the difficulties that created.
Nobody can talk about those things. But I'm sure that anything that can be said would be in an article like this.
So I guess we'll just read the article and we'll stop talking to people about it.
Yes, don't talk to people. People are the worst.
People are the worst because you got to go outside and you're going to talk to somebody and they're going to like cough and then shake your hand or something, and then you're going to get sick, and then it's going to be a big whole thing.
God, what would happen if an alpha died on you right now and you just had to relive your illness over and over and over again?
You know, if I was the same level of sickness every single day, I think I'd probably get used to it, and then it would just be the base level of it's the same thing with getting old, where you wake up and you need like a certain amount of coffee before you even feel like a human. It would be the same sort of thing. I would just wake up and feel like crap, which I kind of do, just a different kind of crap.
So would you say that you would be down with the sickness?
No, I would not say that, because that's terrible.
Oh, okay. I see.
I do not have a metal goatee.
Okay. Well, nobody should. Unless it's added digitally to cover tracking markers on your chin. But I don't know.
I don't have tracking markers on my chin. I have hair on my chin.
Okay. You don't have to be so defensive, Dan.
No tracking markers by the hair on my chinny chin. Never mind. I think I need to lay down.
Yes.